It's Central Time. I'm Keely Bultina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new book has some fresh takes on evolutionary leaps, how we came from fish and ancient viruses inside us. First, many Wisconsinites have sent their questions about the state's response through our Wisconsin project about COVID-19. And Wisconsin's reaction to the spread of COVID-19 is changing. The initial public health response now encompasses nearly every sector of society, from schools to first responders and businesses. WPR's Brady Carlson put some of those questions to Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers earlier today. In the hours since they spoke, the state announced a ban on crowds of 10 people or more and the closing of bars and restaurants, except for delivery and takeout, effective at 5 p.m. today. Here's a listen to their conversation.
Many people are asking questions now about testing guidelines and the availability of tests. What is the state currently doing to expand access to testing, and who should be getting tested now?
We are continuing to work with the federal government on this issue. It's a complex issue. Clearly, there was some delay in the federal government getting started. So we are in a position to continue to do the testing we need to do at this point in time. Clearly, we need to ramp it up. I know the Department of Health has worked with other private entities to put them online to do testing. And right now, it's pretty simple. If people feel that they're not feeling well, they go to the doctor. The doctor decides that they should do this test. Then the test is done. We at one point in time were required to go through the federal government to make this happen. So now it's our local physicians and their staff that will be making that decision.
The White House yesterday advised people to avoid any gatherings of 10 people or more. Many states in Milwaukee County, among others, have closed restaurants and bars for in-person service as a result of that. Given how quickly federal guidance has changed, should Wisconsin change its order, currently saying no more than 50 people at a gathering at a time, should we make that 10 people?
Well, that's a great question. As you know, this is all evolving as we speak, and I'm sure it's going to evolve as we go forward. So when we made that decision yesterday, we were following the CDC recommendation of 50. I think people get it. The basic message here is that social distancing is really, really important. And whether it's 50 or 10, the bottom line is we need people to make sure that they're using social distancing. That's the only way we're going to make sure that this virus doesn't spread at an astronomical rate. But that said, we're always reevaluating that situation about the actual numbers. But I think the people of Wisconsin get it. We should be limiting greatly the number of people we interact with on a daily basis. That said, we also have to make sure that our healthcare workers and our emergency responders are in a position to be able to do their work also. So it's very complex, but we are monitoring that and changing when we decide that it's appropriate.
Perhaps the question we've gotten more than any other is why childcare facilities have been allowed to remain open if schools have been ordered to close for K-12.
Yeah, there's several reasons. One is they are able to close if they wish, and several have. But we also have to make sure that the people that work in our hospitals and our first responders and our physicians and others who use childcare, they have to be able to know that their kids are taken care of, so that they can take care of us. And so child care facilities are a top priority, as are, you know, just to go to a different place here. We have to make sure that our food, the foods that we have are readily available. So we believe that there's certain people in the state that need the child care system to be in place, and we're working with them to make that happen. There are some people that do the work to make sure that we're safe, make sure that we're healthy, their kids are taken care of.
On the flip side, we've received questions from parents who have to continue to work and can't afford childcare with children out of school. What kind of assistance might be available for them going forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. We're working with, obviously, the federal government plays a role. The state will play a role in that. We're evaluating that as we speak. And whether it's small businesses, big businesses, or the people that work there, you know, Wisconsin is not a particularly wealthy state, so as it relates to average income. So I understand what you just said. And I believe the state and federal government has some responsibility to help people continue to thrive financially and otherwise. And so we'll be looking at opportunities at the state level. Obviously, I believe the federal government should have a huge role in playing this, and that's exactly what the House of Representatives bill is about, is keeping people whole financially. And I think that's important to our economy. You know, our economy is driven by consumer demand, and if people don't have any money, we will lapse into a severe recession. So I'm hopeful that both the state, but most importantly, the federal government steps up and makes people whole financially.
We've seen a number of states like Ohio postpone primaries. Should Wisconsin move forward with the April election?
Well, that's still under review. I believe at this time, we believe it still should happen. Most importantly, we have our ability to do early voting or absentee balloting is really to be emphasized, and we've already had hundreds of thousands of people already take advantage of that. So that's the important thing that people can continue to do. Now, I have to point a difference between Ohio and Wisconsin. This is a general election in Wisconsin. This we have all sorts of people that are running for office on a nonpartisan basis. This is not a primary except for the presidential race. And so it's much more complex decision for us than it is Ohio, where they just are doing a presidential thing. We have mayors, we have county executives, we have school board members, we have city council people all across the state, and they take office shortly after they are elected. And so it's important. So at the present time, we are emphasizing absentee balloting and also making sure that they get people vote early.
Are you looking at potential further changes for the state workforce? Is there other guidance that might need to be issued to, say, limit the amount of people who are in a state office, for example, or to minimize contact with the public in certain departments?
Yeah, and we are already doing that. I was on a 2-hour phone call last night, and we have several of our agencies already at 85% telecommuting, and we'll continue to work on that. That I think has been a pretty good success story. Obviously, when you talk about certain agencies such as health and social services, and corrections, and others, you can't telecommute and be a prison guard at the same time. So we have to make sure that we do this smart, but we are doing everything we can, and we're one of the largest employers in the state, to make sure that that work is done. Telecommuting is a top priority.
And one last question for you. Obviously, guidance is changing sometimes day to day or even hour to hour about the response across the country and here in Wisconsin. Last week, you ordered that schools would be closed until April 6th. And you said at that time that the date may change. When do you and other officials start to revisit that decision and look at whether the order closing schools and maybe some of these other orders might need to be extended?
Well, absolutely. We are analyzing that every single day and, frankly, every single minute. It is a fluid situation, and we're continuing to analyze that. We won't wait till the last minute to make that decision, but it's important for people to understand we're monitoring this, and we're relying on science to make these decisions. But there will be many decisions that are made between now and when this virus is taken care of, and I'm very confident the people of Wisconsin are very resilient, and they pull together to make sure that everybody's safe. They've done that before in floods and tornadoes and other things. This is a much bigger scale, but I've been very pleased by the response.
And that was Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers talking with WPR's Brady Carlson earlier today about the COVID-19 outbreak and the effect that it's having on our state. Your questions submitted as part of our Wisconsin Project informed their conversation. You can send questions and get the latest coverage about the outbreak at WPR.org/COVID. Just ahead, there's a lot more we know now about human DNA and how viruses are actually part of who we are as human beings. We learn more from a paleontologist. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Now we're talking about the history of how humans are built and how viruses fit into our genetic picture. We actually have a relationship with viruses that's more complex than you might think. It's one of the many insights about our development as a species in a new book, and we've got the author with us. There's also a line for your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you wonder about how viruses and human beings are connected? What questions do you have about human DNA and how much we even know about it? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Neil Shubin is a professor and paleontologist at the University of Chicago. His book is called Some Assembly Required, Decoding 4 Billion Years of Life from Ancient Fossils to DNA. Professor Shubin, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, great to be back here. Good afternoon.
Let's start with those viruses. You wrote in the Wall Street Journal recently that viruses are a part of us, that we're actually full of ancient viruses. How does that work?
Yeah, we've had, you know, we've lived in about 20 years of genome projects where we have the Human Genome Project, the Rice Genome Project, genome projects for thousands of species. And one thing we've learned, particularly about our own DNA, is that our genes, the parts that encode the proteins, the genes inside our genome, are only 2% of it. That is, if you look at the genome, fully 8% of it are ancient viruses that somehow entered our DNA but got knocked out. They're no longer functional. So you can think about our DNA, our genome, as being a graveyard for ancient viruses. It's truly remarkable that they outnumber our own genes 4-1.
And how have we figured this out?
Yeah, in the genome projects, when you look at the genome, there's a signature of a particular sequence, a particular structure to viruses. And you can find that by probing the DNA, and you can just see how common it is. But there's another approach that happened that's actually kind of even more astounding in some ways. Researchers at the University of Utah were working on, they weren't virologists, they weren't working on viruses. They were working on a gene that functions during memory. It's called ARC. It's a gene in humans and in mammals that works as we make memories. And they were looking at this gene and looking at the structure of the gene, and they discovered that it looked for all the world like a virus. And indeed, the more they looked and the more they analyzed its structure, the more they came to the conclusion that this gene that functions in our memories to make memories was once a virus that invaded our DNA long ago, eons ago, that the DNA of our distant ancestors, and then was repurposed to be used in memories. I mean, just an incredible, vivid example of, you know, just the role that our relationship with viruses has been over the eons. You know, they can disrupt our world, they can wreck our world, the way we get, you know, the way we interact with each other, but they're also a part of our genetic makeup, and sometimes they're put to use.
Yeah, I appreciate the fact that you bring that up, because right now, when we're talking about viruses, there's so much attention on this pandemic with COVID-19, and I think we're thinking of viruses as an invader, as something that is a threat, and what you're saying is that's not necessarily the case all the time.
Not all the time. They are invaders, no doubt about it. They are the ultimate parasites. And it's just what they are is little chunks of genetic material surrounded by a shell. And they're just basically programmed to enter a cell and take it over. And take it over with one purpose, to make more copies of themselves. They have different strategies of doing that. But at the end of the result is they can produce each host cell attacked by a virus turns into a factory that can make as many as a million of them before it bursts apart. So think of these things as the ultimate parasite. And that strategy is so enormously successful. By some estimate, there's about 10 to the 31st viruses in the ocean. That's a 10 with 31 zeros after it. That number of viruses in the ocean, an estimate, of course, is larger than the estimate of the number of stars in the known universe. You know, so viruses are amazingly successful. They're not going anywhere. What we have to do is modulate and control our relationship to them. Sometimes it's beneficial. A lot of times it's neutral. And a lot of times it can be very harmful.
Yeah, Neil Shubin is a professor and paleontologist at the University of Chicago, and we are talking about what we know about DNA and our connection to other organisms here. You have a line at 800-642-1234. You can ask a question about viruses in human beings or something about DNA as we focus on that. Again, that number is 800-642-1234. There's a lot in your book, Professor Shubin, that's more than viruses. You write that DNA technology has advanced rapidly in recent years. Help us put that into context. I mean, how much more do we know about DNA now than we used to?
Oh, it's an enormous amount. We know a lot about DNA that is just so surprising. Think about it this way. Each strand of DNA inside our cells is 6 feet long, yet it's wrapped up and folded on itself to be inside a microscopic cell. We have enough DNA in our bodies. If you laid it all end to end and stretched it out, it would go essentially from here, the planet Earth, to Pluto, which is remarkable. And so what we're learning is, what is the DNA that helps build bodies? How does it, you know, how does the DNA act as we develop from a fertilized egg, a single cell, to an adult, which has 4 trillion cells? And what we're learning is how genes are turned on and off during that process to orchestrate the building of our bodies. And the more we look, the more we learn that the toolkit, the DNA-based toolkit that builds our bodies, is also shared with other mammals, with reptiles, with amphibians, with fish, and in some cases, flies and worms. It's truly remarkable. It's revealing our deep connection to the rest of life on our planet.
And yet, is this one of those situations where now that we know more, we're learning how much we actually don't know about DNA and how it functions and its role and how it came about?
Yes, exactly. That's just a wonderful, wonderful question, because that's what science is about. Each time we make a discovery, we open up new questions we didn't even think of before. And in fact, those questions turn out to be like enormous. Like in this case, we have technologies that can show us each gene in our bodies, and we can see the genes that are active during the building of our bodies. But what we don't know is how those genes act together to actually construct organs and tissues. You know, that's going to take an understanding of a lot of physics and chemistry, you know, as we go, as we study embryological development. But on, you know, 5 to 10 years, we will begin to have those answers.
Shifting gears to evolution, you use the line to the effect of nothing ever happens when you think it's happening. What misconceptions about evolution and timing are you trying to clear up these days?
Well, you know, the more we look at DNA and the more we look at fossils, the more we realize that many of the features that are related to some of the great moments in evolution, like just take one example, lungs and the invasion of land by fish. When fish evolved to walk on land, you know, people associate that with lungs, feathers and the origin of birds. Well, each of those great inventions came about well before the major revolution they're associated with. That is, lungs came about in fish well before animals took their first steps on land. Feathers came about in dinosaurs well before the first creatures took to flight. And this is true over and over again. What we're seeing is evolution as the ultimate repurposer, as the ultimate tinkerer, as like that person who just never throws anything away and just basically uses the old to build the new. And it's really sort of, these are game-changing observations in many ways, but some of these ideas actually, you know, go back to the Darwinian era.
And let's swing back into viruses. Now, we've got Tom from Port Wing who has a question for us. Hi, Tom.
Hi. My question is, as the virus increases and it mutates, does it become stronger or weaker as it increases in population and its mutations?
Okay. Thanks, Tom. Yeah. The fact that viruses might degrade or improve, how do we measure that? How do we figure that out?
Yeah, that's true. It can go both ways. Viruses have different abilities to mutate. Some of them actually have inside their little genome, if you can call it that, they have a proofreading system. So some of them actually can correct mistakes, so they don't evolve as fast. Others evolve super fast. And that mutation and that evolution sometimes that we see in the viruses, often that we often see in viruses, can happen both ways. It can take a fairly lethal virus and make it less lethal. It can take a rapidly spreading virus that's not lethal and make it lethal. The biggest, you know, way to control viruses, obviously, is our technologies, including our social technologies, social distancing. We also have technologies that can disrupt the viral life cycle, keep it from reproducing. And obviously, our immune response is another big piece of it. And vaccines are obviously a huge chunk of that.
All right. And we've got Louise from Dodgeville who also has a question. Louise, thanks for being here with us.
Hi. Your guest kind of alluded to it just right now, but I was watching a PBS special on the Spanish flu of 1918. So can your guest just speak to the evolution of viruses a little bit further? And yeah, the balance between viruses evolving and our immune system trying to battle them. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Louise.
Yeah.
What do you think, Neil?
Yeah, it's a total arms race. We're at war with viruses. Okay, they are continually invading us, trying to attack our cells, and our immune system is continually trying to ward them off. And what we have inside of our immune system is a library, honestly, of ancient infections. So we, you know, there's a record of the ancient viral infections we had in each of us. That's a byproduct of that war. The problem is our immune system doesn't adapt often quickly enough. That is, a virus can, you know, have its effects on the body before our immune system can fully resolve it. So that's the challenge. That's why we rely on vaccines. That's why I rely on antiviral therapies. And that's why right now, absent both of those, we're relying on social distancing.
There are numerous instances where we've seen scientists be reluctant or defensive when faced with the idea that we can see significant biological change happening rapidly instead of gradually over those eons. You seem okay with that tension. What is most interesting that you find about that idea that sometimes things might be able to move quickly?
Oh, they do move quickly. When we look at, one of the things we realize is that, you know, I'm a paleontologist, and so I'm working on timescales that are millions of years long. But, you know, when we look at timescales of biology, at timescales of embryology and how we go from embryo to adult or viral invasions and so forth, those things happen incredibly fast. So, you know, fast for a paleontologist is something that happens over a million years, which is incredibly slow for somebody thinking about, you know, about DNA changes. You know, but what we're learning is DNA can change very, very, very rapidly.
All right. Professor Shubin, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
That was Neil Shubin, professor and paleontologist at the University of Chicago, talking to him today about his new book, Some Assembly Required, Decoding 4 Billion Years of Life from Ancient Fossils to DNA. Coming up after the news, we have incidents of anti-Semitism in Wisconsin rising by more than 50% between 2018 and 2019. We'll talk about what we saw around the state and how communities can respond. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's presidential primary is still scheduled for April 7th, but the State Elections Commission is looking at different ways to make it happen given the COVID-19 outbreak. We have an update coming up. First, a new report from Milwaukee's Jewish Community Relations Council finds that incidents of anti-Semitic behavior in Wisconsin went up between 2018 and 2019. That aligns with a larger trend in the last 4 years. Incidents ranged from the actions of official hate groups to social media posts and even threats in Wisconsin's middle schools. Earlier this month, the group held a public conversation in Whitefish Bay about the audit and what communities can do to discourage anti-Semitism. Ann Jacobs is the chair of the Jewish Community Relations Council that's part of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation. She talked earlier today with Central Time producer Dean Knetter.
So the audit lays out different types of anti-Semitic activity and tracks each of those. Before we zoom in on them, can you give us a sense of how many incidents we saw in 2019 and how that compares to recent years?
Sure. Our audit this year documented 73 corroborated incidents of anti-Semitism. This was a fairly significant impact over 2018-19 year, which was, it's about 55% up from last year. More astonishing was that this reflects a 329% increase over 2015. So in a period of only 4 years, we've seen a massive increase.
Most all of the types of incidents you tracked went up. One in particular was direct harassment, threats, and assaults. There were 40 instances you found last year. That's up from zero in 2015. Do you have a sense of why that's gotten so much worse?
There's a lot of different thoughts on why people feel so emboldened to say things directly to another person in ways that we haven't seen before. And I don't have a good answer of why, but what we do know is the sort of comments are astonishingly hurtful and harmful. And people were willing to say it out loud and didn't really seem to think they were doing anything out of the ordinary.
And when we talk about those direct threats and assaults, what kind of actions are we looking at there?
Oh, things like saying things. A lot of times it had to do with Holocaust references.
Mm-hmm.
I wish you would have, I'm sort of summarizing or giving an example, I wish you would have died in the ovens, things like that. And so they're really targeted attacks on somebody invoking Jewish heritage and anti-Semitic and Holocaust-related imagery.
Another one of the categories in your audit that caught my eye was middle school activity. What kinds of things were we seeing happen in schools?
It was very interesting. In past years, we had seen some of this going on at the high school level, and we had been watching that closely. And this year, we saw it trickling down into the middle school age group. So kids were saying things about how, you know, if you were in the Holocaust, did you want to be shot or be gassed? So some pretty shocking statements from young kids. And it's interesting because they had just enough knowledge of the Holocaust and things like that to know how to say something incredibly hurtful. And because they're in middle school, to a certain extent, lacking the understanding of how profoundly harmful that is, it was jarring.
And that is a time, as you said, when kids are starting to learn about things like the Holocaust and how racism and anti-Semitism have played out in history. Does the education in classrooms need to look at the historical facts and the ways that that thinking is showing up today, too?
I think that the people who are doing some of the best teaching are including that. Because it is more than teaching sort of here are the facts and here are the numbers. It is also teaching about empathy. It is also teaching about how did we allow as a society these things to happen and what were the actions there, and a recognition of how that harm continues to translate. So I think that the broader the curriculum, including both Holocaust education, but also this greater understanding of our diverse community and the importance of us not instilling hate in all of its myriad forms is key.
There were also a number of incidents in Wisconsin last year connected with official hate groups. What form does that type of activity usually take?
So back in the day, it used to be we would get faxes, and nobody faxes anymore. And now what we're seeing are emblems, graffiti, stickers, and some social media. So we're seeing the KKK putting out flyers. We are seeing people like former congressional candidate Paul Nehlen invoking all sorts of hate group symbolisms and call to action. We're seeing the Patriot Front, which has this very ordinary looking red, white, and blue sticker. Like, what could possibly be anti-Semitic about that sticker turning up? Except that they are a far right wing hate group and they espouse anti-Semitic views. And so when someone's putting their stickers up, it's a beacon to like-minded people like, hey, we're here, come join us. So it was a whole variety of different activities from groups.
We're talking with Ann Jacobs right now, chair of the Jewish Community Relations Council, looking at their audit of anti-Semitic incidents in Wisconsin last year, which went up more than 50% from 2018. And Ann, if one of us listening right now sees an anti-Semitic incident like this playing out, maybe it's a comment made to someone in person, maybe it's a social media post, what is the best response? What are the steps we should take?
we would love for people to report what they are seeing. The only way we know how to address these incidents is to know where they're happening, know who's doing them, and then we can figure out the best way to address them, whether they're in schools, in public, anywhere. So people can go to MilwaukeeJewish.org or call us at the Milwaukee Jewish Federation. We will happily take their report. You know, what people can do even is just take a photograph and email it to us. I want to share a little anecdote with you. There was a ski trail in northern Wisconsin that had some swastika spray painted on the trees. This was not a particularly Jewish area, and we don't know why somebody chose to do that. It was reported to us. But what was even better was that the community came together and went through the entire ski trail, removing all of them as a community because they didn't want that hate in their community. So we want to know about it, but we also know that there are people out there who really don't want hate and are willing to work with us as allies. And that is a warm feeling despite all of this horrible information.
You mentioned allies there, and I imagine another important aspect of the solution is building relationships between faith communities and religious groups to get their help on educating people about anti-Semitism. What are the steps in building those alliances?
Rarely does hate stop with just one small group. People who hate tend to be equal, or not equal opportunity haters, but tend to hate a whole lot of different people. So it's a matter of working within our community writ large. And so that means building alliances, whether it's formal alliances, for example, through the Interfaith Council, whether it's more person-to-person alliances simply by being present in our larger community. It means supporting our neighbors, our friends, when things happen in their communities. So when the shooting in New Zealand happened and there was a prayer vigil in the mosque here in Milwaukee, it was essential that the Jewish community be present for that. Why? Because when things like that happen to one of us, they happen to all of us, and we need to be there for each other.
And when you hear people around Wisconsin talking about incidents like these and anti-Semitism more generally, do you get a sense that there is a real desire to address this problem head on?
Oh, I think so. I think that there is a real awareness of how toxic this is and corrosive it can be. So in some ways, while social media spreads it, which is unfortunate, at the same time, people can see it and call it out because they know that it isn't only anti-Semitism. It is also racism. It is also anti-Muslim sentiment. It is also. It is all the different groups. And so I think there's a growing recognition that we need to speak out because it will touch all of us.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for talking with us today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Anne Jacobs is the chair of the Jewish Community Relations Council, which is part of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation. She talked with Central Time producer Dean Knetter about the group's audit of anti-Semitic incidents in Wisconsin last year, which were up 55% over the year before. Next, the State Elections Commission is urging Wisconsin residents to vote by mail in the April 7th election. We explain how to do that coming up. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Still ahead, entire grocery aisles are dedicated to health food products and supplements. There's CrossFit and SoulCycle, hashtag doing things. America has embraced the fitness lifestyle, and so have our pocketbooks. So we're talking about the modern world's fit culture later on in this show. Now, it's election day in three states, Florida, Illinois, and Arizona. Ohio was also supposed to hold its presidential primary today, but the governor announced late last night that polls would be closed due to the COVID-19 outbreak. Given that disruption caused by the virus is expected to continue for the foreseeable future, questions are mounting about what this means for Wisconsin's elections. Those are just 3 weeks from today. The State Elections Commission has already taken action, including urging people to cast their votes by mail. The commission is scheduled to meet again tomorrow to discuss further measures.
Laurel White covers state government for Wisconsin Public Radio. Laurel, good to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So long lines, a full crew of poll workers voting at the usual sites, these kinds of things that we're used to seeing on Election Day, not so likely for Wisconsin, right?
Right. I mean, the State Elections Commission actually met last week in an emergency meeting to start addressing some of these concerns. I mean, they're many-fold at this point. They include many early voting sites in Wisconsin closing, places like libraries, for example. We know those are often early voting locations in the state. Poll workers have also raised some concerns, or clerks, rather, have raised concerns about poll workers, because those poll workers tend to be a little bit older, generally. Those that volunteer for that kind of job, they're worried about having a shortage of those poll workers because of individuals not being comfortable coming out and working the polls on Election Day. So there are a number of things that election officials are trying to work through ahead of April 7th.
Speaking of those poll workers, what are we considering to try to deal with a potential shortage of them on Election Day?
Well, really the biggest thing that the State Elections Commission and a number of other groups and politicians are pushing is people need to vote absentee now to sort of reduce the influx of people that's going to happen or that could happen on Election Day. Basically, they're saying we need to take advantage of absentee mail-in ballots so there isn't that pressure on polling locations on Election Day, so we can have fewer locations open, not have shortages of workers, and just sort of live in this new reality that we're in now.
How does voting by mail work, though? I mean, can anybody do it? And what about the photo ID issue?
Yeah, so anybody that's eligible to vote in Wisconsin can vote by mail, no problem. The photo ID requirement is obviously still in place. So what you need to do is just be prepared to upload a picture of your photo ID when you request an absentee ballot online. There's a system on the state elections website, myvote.wi.gov, where you can request that ballot and upload a picture right into the website. That's, you know, whatever you normally would use at the polls, like your driver's license, state ID card, passport. You also have the option of sending that request for an absentee mail-in ballot by mail if you want, and including that sort of that photo ID requirement there, just in a photocopy form.
What about if we need to register? Is there a way to do that from home?
Absolutely, and that's a great and very timely question, Keely, because the deadline for that is tomorrow. So if folks still need to register to vote in Wisconsin and be eligible to vote in the April 7th election, they need to register tomorrow. Now, there is a caveat there. The registration that I'm talking about is online voter registration, which is, of course, what's being pushed right now. You could still register at your local clerk's office. You can register on Election Day in Wisconsin. So it's not the absolute total cutoff for registering to vote, but it's the cutoff for people that don't want to go out in the world, that don't want to leave their homes. You know, they're doing that cocooning that we're all supposed to do. So if you need to register, you can register online, myvote.wi.gov. It'll be a similar process to requesting that absentee ballot. You'll need to upload a proof of residence document, some of those other forms that you would otherwise provide in person.
And Laurel filed a really good Q&A story about voting by mail. And if you want to learn more about how that works, you can go to WPR.org/Central Time. We are talking with Laurel White, who is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter, about how COVID-19 is affecting our elections. We've got an election scheduled for April 7th. Laurel, the Elections Commission is giving those local officials some flexibility to relocate those physical polling places. How much latitude are they giving them?
So they're giving them a pretty wide berth there in terms of deciding what an appropriate polling place is for April 7th. They approved this at their emergency meeting last week, basically trying to get an advance move on getting some of these polling places moved out of places like nursing homes, for example. We know that wouldn't be a great place for people to be congregating right now to go cast ballots. So under the new policy that was approved, it doesn't just apply to nursing homes. Essentially, local election officials can work with local health officials identify places that they think might be problematic, and then shift people to a different site. Now, as I mentioned before, we could be potentially talking about a shortage of poll workers, right? So it could just be that those polling locations won't function anymore. We'll be minimizing the number of polling locations in total. And hopefully, because people are voting early, there won't be a strain on those locations.
And if I do want to vote in person, and if that is still allowed by the time we get to April 7th, how am I supposed to know that my polling place has changed?
Well, your local election officials are going to be required to publicize that information. So they will have to have details on their website. They are going to have to make sure that they have been completely transparent about any changes that are made to polling locations. The Elections Commission was still working out specifically what some of those requirements would be in terms of letting folks know. This is obviously a really unique situation for election workers. There's actually a state law that bars them from moving a polling place site up to a certain point before an election. We're within that window. So what the Elections Commission did was actually lift that restriction so they'd be able to do that. And we're in a little bit of a gray area, but they should be notifying folks if a polling place closes.
We mentioned Ohio postponing its primary today. Louisiana and Georgia did that last week. Maryland is pushing theirs back from the end of April to early June. Is that being considered here in Wisconsin?
That is really the million-dollar question right now in Wisconsin. I feel like every time that we get in touch with the governor or the legislative leaders, we ask, what about postponing the election? What about postponing the election? The latest from the governor and leaders just today is that they don't see the need to do that. They're really pushing, again, this absentee voting, mail-in ballot voting. Governor Evers actually had a really interesting point when he brought it up today. He said Wisconsin is different from some of these other states that are postponing their elections because they're holding just presidential primaries in their state. We have a number of other things on the ballot on April 7th. We have a state Supreme Court race. We have actually a constitutional amendment on the ballot for statewide approval. A number of other judicial races for appellate court seats and circuit court justice bench seats. So the governor raised some concerns about, you know, we don't know how long this is going to go on, the spread of this virus. We're risking leaving these positions unfilled or not allowing voters to act on them for kind of an indefinite amount of time if we postpone.
You're following conversations and decisions by the Elections Commission. Do you know, have we heard from them, if they people on the commission feel like they've got a decent handle on COVID-19, or are they worried that this could be a mess?
Well, I think they're really taking it kind of step by step. It's a very fast-moving process. Anybody that's watching the news day-to-day knows just how quickly things are changing. Election officials, when they met last week in that emergency meeting, said, we anticipate we're going to have many more meetings like this to address other problems in the lead up to the April 7th election. They're going to actually have another meeting tomorrow at 4 p.m. to take up some things. We don't know exactly what they're going to be talking about yet. Could be more work with polling locations, could have to do with poll workers, perhaps getting some more resources to smaller clerks' offices to help them handle an influx of mail-in ballot requests. They're getting kind of an unprecedented number of requests right now. And I know in the city of Madison, for example, they've had to recruit from other offices to help them stuff envelopes to send things out. So it's a very unique situation for a lot of folks across the state.
And as we wrap up here, ultimately, who would decide whether the election goes on with modifications or if it were to be delayed?
Well, we know the State Elections Commission does not have that power, so it wouldn't come from them. It would need to be the governor, the legislature, or the courts. The most common answer seems to be it would need to be legislative action because the date of this particular election is actually written into state law. So if the governor were to use his emergency powers to change the election date, that could potentially spur some lawsuits. We're not entirely sure how that would play out.
All right. Thank you so much, Laurel. Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter, and we talked with her about how the COVID-19 outbreak is affecting Wisconsin's April 7th election. You can learn more at WPR.org/Central Time. Many of us human beings are sticking close to home to help contain COVID-19. Not so with rockhopper penguins at the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago. The aquarium is closed to people. Meanwhile, staff members are letting penguins explore and they're visiting other animals. Two of the penguins featured as they tour are named Edward and Annie. It is almost too much for me to handle as they waddle around. Their feet move really, really quickly, and then they stop and they gawk at fish through the glass. It makes me think of this children's book called Penguin Problems that's full of complaints about this world throughout the whole book. And then at the very end, there's this message of hope and gratefulness with a sprinkle of sass. And we are... Speaking of sass, I just want to mention, too, that we can see the penguins on this March 17th with St. Patrick's Day themed outfits, including a sequined green bow tie. It is incredibly dashing and incredibly adorable, if I do say so myself. So take a look at that. And thank you so much for being with us today. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.